This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, to introduce our guest speaker tonight, may I introduce the Deputy Chair of the National Museum of Australia, a wonderful scholar of Australian history and the Scholar Emeritus at La Trobe University, Dr. John Hirst.
Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, the Darwin exhibition that we are opening is in this direction. This way are the permanent galleries, the permanent exhibitions. And the first gallery you come to is called Old New Land. And that gallery displays how the first European settlers in this place found the flora and fauna so puzzling. The scientists found it puzzling. Darwin, when he was here, found it puzzling. He wrote that if you were an unbeliever, this is a wonderful play with himself, if you were an unbeliever, you might think there had been two creators. But then he rapidly went on to say in his diary, that of course there was only one creation, but there was a great amount of variety within it. He was still a long way from developing his theory on evolution. But you can see, and we all know this about the voyage of the Beagle, that the thinking had begun. So we have a particular reason for being very interested in Darwin. And we are very pleased to have this exhibition from the American Museum of Natural History, and pleased to have Alan Drager here and his colleague Katie MacDonald. And I also welcome from the Art Exhibitions Australia, who make all these things happen, Robert Mackay and Carol Henry. The staff of the museum also deserve our thanks, not only for putting this exhibition in place, but as Alan has already said, for creating a sort of annex which discusses Darwin in Australia. We can't be too proud about Darwin in Australia. Though he found the flora and fauna fascinating, he was half disgusted by the people. He didn't think this place had much of a future. As you've heard, Barry Jones is to open the exhibition. He is well known to most of you. For our foreign visitors and guests, I can say he was previously the Commonwealth Minister of Science. He was also, and I'm sure he's prouder of this, one of the first, if not the first, writer to tell us about the new world of IT, which he did some decades ago in a book called Sleeper's Wake. I learnt recently a new thing about Barry Jones. He is the only single person to be a member of the four learned academies. Is four right, Barry? He would correct me if I were wrong. Technology, science, humanities, and social science. These are not honorary positions. He's earned his right to them all. Ladies and gentlemen, Barry Jones.
John and Alan and Dennis and friends, thank you very much for the generous introduction. And I am particularly excited to be here to open, and very flattered to be asked to open this exhibition, because Darwin is a real hero. But if you think that this speech sounds like a work in progress, or as we sometimes say, winging it, well, it is. But I don't need to explain that in Canberra, because this is what politicians or ex-politicians habitually do. But in a sense, until I actually saw the exhibition itself, which I had the opportunity to do from mid-afternoon on, although I thought endlessly about Darwin and continued my reading a good deal, I didn't know exactly what I was going to say, because I didn't know exactly what it was that I'd be reacting to. You have to understand the significance of this. What you're about to see is not one, but two exhibitions, in a way, folded into one. The first, Darwin, which comes from the, as you've been told, the American Museum of Natural History, and which has been curated by Niles Eldridge, about whom I'll say something in a few minutes. And then next to it is the very interesting but smaller exhibition called Darwin in Australia, which Michael Pickering has curated. And it's fascinating to see the two things, the two exhibitions together. It's interesting that Darwin sometimes claimed that it was his observation of slavery in South America which was a major factor in his interest in natural selection. And it's one of those nice coincidences that life abounds in. Although it appears in Niles Eldridge's book, it doesn't, you wouldn't pick it up from the exhibition itself. But it's one of those nice coincidences that Abraham Lincoln, who effectively freed the slaves in the United States, was born on the same day, the 12th of February, 1809, as Darwin. So in February, we'll be celebrating the 200th birthday of two of the great, really seminal figures of the 19th century. Now, each, I'm sure, must have been aware of the other, and they must have been aware of the coincidence of sharing the same birthday and the same birth year, but I don't recall any reference to the fact in his letters. But in this excellent book of Niles Eldridge called Darwin, Discovering the Tree of Life, he begins with these words, and I'll just quote them for a moment. It says, Charles Robert Darwin was born on 12th of February, 1809, the very same day as Abraham Lincoln. Both men shook the world in their own time. Both detested slavery. And both now have their images on the low denomination, hence more common, paper currency of their natal country. Lincoln, of course, is on the $5 bill. Darwin is on the British £10 note, where he replaced another prominent Victorian figure, Charles Dickens, in the year 2000. The ranks of towering 19th century figures who retain a firm grasp on 21st century collective consciousness are rapidly thinning. Darwin replaced Dickens on the £10 note, it was joked, because he had the nicer beard. But the truth is that Darwin, like Lincoln, retains a relevance to life in the 21st century that Dickens has all but lost. So too have Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud begun to fade, astonishing given the amount of controversy they both engendered well into the latter half of the 20th century. Lincoln survives as the saviour of the Union and symbolises at home and throughout the world the deeply humanitarian impulse that is still far from fully realised in the modern body politic. He's an icon of hope for social decency, as yet not realised, yet thankfully far from forgotten. Toe too with Charles Darwin. In a recent poll in Great Britain, which BBC viewers voted for their top 10 all-time British figures, Darwin came in fourth, behind Winston Churchill, Isambard Kingdom Brunel, and Princess Diana. Now, as I said, the reason why Darwin was placed higher than Shakespeare or Newton or Elizabeth I or Queen Victoria remains unexplored. But, says Eldridge, what Darwin did was to transform the prevailing view of stability of the Earth, of all the species on Earth, and not least the stability of society's strata, into a picture of motion. Let enough time go by and the laws of biological transformation will inexorably and inevitably transform life on Earth. Old species will go, replaced by new ones. Darwin was a prodigious worker. He's also a great organizer of material. And I couldn't help thinking about one of the parallels between the work of Darwin and the work of James Murray, the editor of the great multi-volume OED, and their period of work overlapped. See, both developed a great network of correspondents who would carry out work in entomology and etymology, respectively, and send specimens to be catalogued. And it was Janet Brown, one of Darwin's great biographers, estimated Darwin's postal bill in one of her biographies, and I apologise for not checking the figures, but I think it was around £800 per annum for stamps. And that was a time when penny post was absolutely standard. And it meant, too, it was very... He used his family effectively. He had ten children, and they were all set to work to make sure that they were able to help catalogue the material. Darwin's great work was really stimulated to a large extent by his travelling around on the Beagle in that great voyage from 1831 to 1836. I'm looking at my watch because I've been told no more than 20 minutes, so I'll try and cram a lot in. And of course, in that great voyage, probably the most significant site that he went to was the Galapagos Islands, because he couldn't help but be struck by the astonishing species variation between the various islands in the Galapagos, even though the distances between them were not very great. But they were great enough to have a process over a long time of being undisturbed, where species could develop factors which were specific to the actual environment that they were in. And then, of course, he travelled across the Pacific, went briefly to the Bay of Islands in New Zealand, then came on to Australia, and he, in the 61 days he spent in Australia, he began in Sydney, went from Sydney up to Bathurst, looked at the Blue Mountains, then went down to Tasmania, and spent quite some time in and around Hobart, climbed up Mount Wellington, and then off to Western Australia, to what we now call Albany, but the area that was then called King George's Sound, and then back to England, but collecting all the time. There are a whole number of intellectual influences, very powerful intellectual influences. One was, of course, his own grandfather. His own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, a very powerful speculative thinker, who wrote a book called Zoonomia, in which he speculated about something very much like what Darwin came up with, the idea of the survival of the fittest, the struggle for survival and what we now call an evolutionary process. But because his grandfather had the speculation but didn't have the hard data, it wasn't a process-driven event, as we'd say under the Rudd regime. It wasn't really process-driven, and there hadn't even been an inquiry into it. So it meant that... But he had the idea. And there was an interesting writer, a publisher, called Robert Chambers, who wrote quite a useful speculative book around 1844, which anticipated some of the ideas involved in evolution, but not the techniques, not the way in which it actually worked. And because Robert Chambers' work wasn't based on any kind of empirical data, it wasn't based on observation, it was simply based on speculation. And if you look in the exhibition, you'll find there's some useful material there which will enable you to understand about Robert Chambers' work in the 1840s. Darwin was also very much influenced by the important pioneering economist and authority on population, Thomas Robert Malthus. Now, I know that it's true that in the film treatment he's described as Malthus, but J.M. Keynes, who knew a lot about these things, J.M. Keynes was very emphatic that the pronunciation was Malthus, because it's really a corruption of the words malt house, although I concede that it's a bit more awkward to say Malthusian rather than Malthusian, which we're so used to. But I think Malthus is really right, and perhaps in the next iteration of the exhibition you might give some thought to change. But in his very famous essay on population, he took the view that species produced more than the ecology was able to survive, was able to support. And as a result, those that died were those that were stronger. You had a process of the survival of the fittest. Anyway, Darwin had this massive material, but because he was independently wealthy, he didn't need to publish or perish. There are probably very few scientists with as strong an economic background as he did. His father had been a very successful investor, and when Darwin died, he left a fortune. But he had in mind the idea of publishing something very much like The Origin of Species, but then was overcome with anxiety about how his work would be interpreted. And he was particularly sensitive that he'd become subject to attack, that his work would seem as overturning the conventional views about the immutability of species. And the result was that he postponed and postponed and postponed. And as all of you will know, and it's very well set out in the exhibition here, until his hand was forced in 1858 by the revelation that Alfred Russel Wallace, working independently in Indonesia, or the Dutch East Indies, had come up with virtually the same conclusions, but not in quite the same detail as Darwin. It meant that unless Darwin published what he was working on, then all the credit, all the recognition was going to go to Wallace. And Darwin found that excruciatingly painful. So the result was that on the 30th of June, 1858, there was a joint presentation at the Linnaean Society in London of two papers, on, in a sense, evolution and the process of natural selection, one by Wallace and the other by Darwin. Interestingly, the two authors didn't attend the presentation. They had people doing it for them. And in the case of Darwin, his paper was presented by the great geologist Lyell and the great botanist Hooker. But from the beginning, Wallace very generously conceded that although Darwin had been very slow to publish, that in fact the detail of his work and the detail of his observations and the work that he'd put in his notebooks was really far more sophisticated, far more detailed, far more advanced than the work that Wallace had himself done. I should draw your attention, I think, to an interesting passage in one of the recent issues of Nature, because Nature had had Darwin as its figure on the cover. He was treated on the cover of a recent edition of Nature, that is the issue of the 20th of November. And Janet Brown, the biographer of Darwin, who I mentioned before, wrote a very interesting essay in which she was making the point that at various times Darwin's record, Darwin's history, has been recognised or commemorated in different kinds of ways. For example, in 1882, when Darwin died, he originally had wanted to be buried in the graveyard next to the church in Down, close to where he lived in Kent. But a group of three, Thomas Henry Huxley, Francis Galton, and an interesting figure, John Lubbock, later Lord Avebury, the man who coined the words Paleolithic and Neolithic, they organised and they persuaded the Dean of Westminster Abbey that Darwin was important enough to be buried in the Abbey. But not only that, he was, well, sort of Christian. And as a result, as he had no clear theological position, even more appropriate to be buried in an Anglican institution. So the result is that they arranged for him to be, but the emphasis at the time was to say that Darwin was a good man, he wasn't an atheist, and his teachings were absolutely no threat to religion or moral values. So that was the view taken about Darwin in 1882. The year 1909 is interesting because it's the centenary, of course, of Darwin's birth and the 50th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. Now, oddly, in 1909, Darwin's theory was seen as being under a bit of a cloud. People perhaps took the view then to say, well, it was an interesting theory, very courageous, but in fact, it's been overtaken a bit by subsequent scientific research. It was seen to be threatened by the new science of genetics, because the new science of genetics suggested that, in fact, species were really much more mutable than Darwin had recognized. You didn't need a long period of time. You didn't need generation after generation after generation. It could, with Drosophila and other species, it could really happen comparatively quickly. And so it could be a short process. And then the other factor was that geology, the interpretation of the geological record, seemed to suggest that evolution was rather a simple process, a kind of a straight line process. One might even call it intelligent design, you know, that it was aiming in a particular direction, and each new species that comes out better than the one before. So the result was that, and it was also thought that there were so many different forms of fragmentation that was popular for people to come out with their own varieties of emphasis on in biology, and the result is that Darwin's one big idea seemed to some extent to be a bit sidelined, that it wasn't as important. So 1909, the centenary year, represented a bit of a doubt. Ooh, we're just on 20 minutes. Yes, all right, well, I'll speed up very quickly. 1959, Darwin's on the upswing again. And that's the impact of the concept of biological systematics, the integration of three elements of genetics, population statistics, and selection theory, and the argument that evolution could take place at three levels, at the molecular, at the genetic, and in the environmental world of organisms. It also meant the end of Lamarckianism, which was blown out of the water, and it was also an attack on directed evolution. And it's after 1959 that you've got this heavy revival of interest in what's going on in the Galapagos and the extraordinary variations going on. 2009, the Darwin's reputation in most parts of the world is probably at its highest point. It's true that polling suggests that 57% of US citizens appear to accept the intelligent design alternative, and that Darwin has to fight to keep his place in the sun. One more thing, perhaps, just to before I wind up, that's not mentioned in the exhibition, which I also think is very interesting, and I think the historians here tonight might be interested in this, and that is the connection between Darwin and Marx. Not even mentioned in the index, by the way, of Eldridge's book. The connection between Darwin and Marx. It's complex and not all is known, but Marx sent Darwin a copy of the second German edition of Capital in 1873 and received a courteous, if somewhat opaque, acknowledgement, because although it's true that Darwin could understand what was written in German, he certainly wasn't fluent and certainly wasn't very comfortable reading German. And then when Marx died in 1883, a year after Darwin, at his funeral, Frederick Engels compared the two great evolutionists. One was the evolutionist who worked in human nature, the other worked in human history. And it's also true that Darwin corresponded with Marx's son-in-law, Edward Aveling, who was very unhappily married to the tragic but remarkable figure, Eleanor Marx, who was Karl Marx's favourite daughter. Isaiah Berlin had it wrong. There's a letter in the Marx correspondence which he thought was a letter directly, which was really aimed at Darwin himself, but it seems pretty clear that Darwin wrote a letter which at one stage was thought to be directed at Karl Marx, but it's almost certainly now that it was aimed at Edward Aveling, the son-in-law. So we have a remarkable record of a great life, somebody who really transformed our thinking about the world, somebody who's spent for much of his life had a debilitating illness, not quite sure what it was. Some view is that he suffered from Chagas disease, which is something that you pick up from a parasite in South America and has symptoms like sleeping sickness. And he certainly had long periods of melancholia and so on, and periods when he couldn't work. Nevertheless, he produced no less than 16 books, and when we look back at Darwin's achievement, we can see he is one of the great figures, not only of the 19th century, but one of those figures whose thinking absolutely shaped the 20th century and well on into the 21st. And I've been warned by Dennis that at all costs, I've got to use the magic words, I now declare the exhibition open.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.